Blog Talk Radio.
Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join me on the broadcast. I apologize. As you can tell, I've got a little problem with the speaking voice today. I have been battling a virus all weekend, and I debated whether to do the program today because usually if you have this problem, it's really hard for people to listen to you. But it's gotten a little bit better, and I've decided I need to speak. I need to do this. I need to be a voice for the voiceless, although in many ways I'm one of the voiceless today, if you will. Well, we have a lot to accomplish on the broadcast today. I want to talk to you, first of all, about the second annual Women's March in Washington and all over the United States. They did this last year, right after the inauguration of President Trump. And, of course, it was much more than a women's rights rally. It was more of a hate campaign against the newly elected president. I don't think anything has changed with this at all. But once again, I have a major complaint against this movement. I have a huge complaint. Where is their voice for the voiceless? Now, first of all, they have a right. First Amendment guarantees them the right to speak out publicly, the right to air their views. I don't have a problem with that. They're right. I do have a major problem with them wanting to destroy the unborn, but I support their right to speak. But my biggest complaint against this movement is their lack of compassion for the voiceless. Everything is about my reproductive rights, my rights. Look, you live in America. You have more rights than anyone in the world. What is your complaint? What are you trashing America for? America has given you everything you need, your job, your career, everything. What is your complaint? And so I was thinking of a way to start this program today in a response to the Women's March. And I have two responses. Number one, my good friend Allison Ashley, who I had the honor of meeting just a couple of weeks ago here in St. Louis. She's all the way coming to me from Australia. A tremendous voice against the Islamic oppressiveness. She is a great voice for the conservative values. And she had this to say about the women's rights movement, the Women's March in Washington. I want you to hear this. When your voices on women being allowed to kill their unborn children are so loud, yet your silence on women suffering torture, incarceration, rape, and execution in countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran is absolutely deafening, you really need to sort out your priorities. Did you hear that? It may be worth repeating. When your voices on women being allowed to kill their unborn children are so loud, yet your silence on women suffering torture, incarceration, rape, and execution in countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran is absolutely deafening, quote, then you really need to sort out your priorities. I couldn't have said it better. Thank you, Allison. I thought about sitting here for the next 10 minutes and talking about what's going on. And I thought about what is the best way to respond to the Women's March. I think the best way is for you to listen to Yazidi survivor Nadia Murad. Yazidi survivor Nadia Murad was kidnapped by ISIS in 2014. Her mother and most of her family were killed by ISIS. Nadia was then kidnapped and made into a sex slave by ISIS. She fortunately was able to escape. And today she is the proud UN ambassador, a voice for the voiceless Yazidis. So the best response to the women's movement this morning is to hear from a woman who is raising her voice about the torture, the kidnapping, the rape of Yazidi women. I want you to hear Miss Nadia Murad.
Your Excellency, Secretary General Ban, Ambassador Mendelssohn, dear Amal, guests and friends, I am most grateful to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime for appointing me Goodwill Ambassador for the dignity of survivors and human trafficking. I stand with you today to represent those who are gone from us. We cannot bring them back. With them in mind, always, we fight on. We have to continue fighting. I was a farmer, a villager, and I was born to be such. I had hopes common to all young girls of my village. I was not raised to give speeches, neither was I born to meet world leaders, nor to represent a cause so heavy and so difficult. Before ISIS came to my village, there was nothing more important to me than my dignity, than my mother, my dear mother. And although she is now gone, my dear mother is with me here today in soul and in spirit. She, along with my brothers and so many others, left this world too soon. And my life in Sinjal as a simple Yazidi farm girl is gone forever. The dreams and hopes of my whole community are gone. As you have heard, the night of August 3rd, 2015, everything changed. Daesh came to kidnap, to murder, to rape. This was genocide. It is that simple. in a matter of days, if not hours. Thousands of Yazidis were killed, and thousands of women and children were taken just because they were Yazidis. I was taken to Mosul with others. I was used in the way they wanted to use me. I was not alone. And perhaps I was the lucky one. As time passed, I found a way to escape where thousands of others could not. They are still captive. Dearest Shami is with us today, dressed just as my mother dressed. She has lost all of her children but one. Shami's young daughters, Jilan and Shilan, committed suicide while in captivity to avoid being brutally raped. Dearest Shireen is here too, who was 20 years old. She was also enslaved and harmed. 23 of her family members were killed or captured. With Daesh, women and children are the fuel that ignites the war. They are traded for sex or labor, trafficked and enslaved. By a divine right, according to Daesh, ISIS does not represent Islam. It uses Islam to justify its crimes. I would like to ask Muslim countries' leaders, and I would like to ask the Muslim community to stand with me and speak out against this distortion of their religion. Over the past few months, I have traveled to Egypt and Kuwait to explain to university students what ISIS is really about and to urge them not to join their ranks. I am honored to be named a goodwill ambassador for the UN, for the dignity of millions of survivors of human trafficking around the world. Their numbers exceed the population of some countries. Maybe I lived so that I would be able to use my heart and soul and my words to be their voice. Today, I speak for thousands of refugees and persecuted people who are displaced, who suffer in refugee camps in Kurdistan, Iraq, Syria, and beyond. And I urge UN members to accept refugees and asylum seekers, particularly the ones who have become victims of genocide and trafficking in person. We must help them. I would like also to thank my community who accepted me and who accepted all the girls who survived with a warm heart. I also thank Germany for giving me and many other Yazidi women a new home. But even today, I am not free. I cannot feel free while thousands of other girls like me are still captive. We must work to find justice for those who are enslaved by Daesh and in the territories under Daesh's control and all over the world. As we speak, over 3,200 Yazidis are still held in captivity by ISIL. We must find them. I call upon the international community to take action to rescue them at once and bring them back to their families. But we must also ensure that those responsible are held accountable for these crimes.
Hey, NBC News fans, thanks for checking out our YouTube channel.
Well, she is a courageous Yazidi survivor. And if you listen carefully to her story, which, by the way, is now a major publication called The Last Girl. I have it on Audible. It is heart-wrenching. It is shocking. It is eye-opening. There's much more detail in the book. There are thousands of Yazidi women still captive by ISIS. I have seen pictures on the internet of Yazidi women in cages being set on fire. And we have a problem with women's rights here in America. Oh, give me a break. I don't think there's any better response to this bogus fake feminism than Nadia Murad, who is the real feminist, if you will, of the world, who understands firsthand what it means to be enslaved to the sexual evil desires of ISIS. And we have a problem here in America with the rights of women. Ask Nadia about that. I don't think you can get a better response. I have a good friend who's a Yazidi. He was on my radio broadcast a couple of months ago. He also is a survivor. His name is Dawood Salih. He has written a book called Walking Alone. It's a book of poetry in his way of describing what he went through, in his way of healing from what he went through. He recently was able to see Nadia's film. It's called On Her Shoulder. It's being released as a documentary. And he wrote something about watching this film, and I want to read it to you. Dawood says, "Today at Sundance Film Festival, while I was in the screening on Nadia's film, quote, On Her Shoulders, lots of emotions mixed together to create hope and resistance within myself. Even though I was crying every time I was watching Nadia with her sad face, which reveals the story of a nation, even though it was so hard for me to hold myself to see my people suffering in this film, I gained much strength to be a voice and do more for my people. I want to fight and do something for those people, no matter what it takes. The hardest moment was when Nadia said, quote, I wish my mom was here, end quote, to see her announcement as a goodwill ambassador of the United Nations. Despite the fact that there was a great moment for her, but she was not happy. I know for sure that we can't bring her mom back, but at least we can fight with her to prevent that this will ever happen again and to find justice for the Yazidis. Nadia is not fighting for herself. She does this for her people. She doesn't want others to go through all that she has suffered, and she takes her strength from her people. She does more than she could do, and still the world doesn't respond. We need to support Nadia Murad. We need to work hard and have common goals which can lead us Yazidis to be a strong and independent nation. We can decide whether we need to live a life of genocides and persecution or change that for something else. We need to come to the acknowledgement that we are the only ones who decide this and no one else does it for us. Yazidis don't need to only live, not to only eat, not to only breathe. They need to stand up and make a nation that all their people will respect. We need to reach a point and start to push ourselves forward to make the first step. We can't go back. If the world doesn't listen to us, then we need to make the world talk about us. I got the courage to stand up and tell the audience at the film that I am a Yazidi genocide survivor, and I will always be proud to be a Yazidi as part of the community who struggles to find justice. It makes me so proud when I know I am in the right side and try to convince the whole world to recognize this. After the movie was finished, a lady came to me and said, quote, you know what? I was working to help refugees for many years, and finally I quit. The movie was so good and will bring much attention to the Yazidi cause. And when you stood up and talked, now I want to work, and I will help until you, Dawood, achieve your goals. These words made me feel that there are many out there, and they're ready to help. There are still many good people. We just need to keep believing in what we do and never stop working. We need to let the world know that the Yazidi genocide will not be forgotten. Thank you, Dawood Salih. I will partner with you and help you to make sure that the world never forgets the Yazidi genocide. The movie is called On Her Shoulders. It's part of the Sundance Film Festival. I want to see this film when it comes to my city, and I hope that I have an opportunity to be there with my Yazidi friends. For the last several weeks, we have been treated to videos of what is happening in Iran with the Iran uprising. More than 5,000 Iranians were arrested, and at least 50 killed on the streets, and several killed while they're incarcerated in prison. This is another example of a voiceless people that needs someone to stand up for them. There is someone that stands up for them, and it's the son of the former Shah of Iran. His name is Reza Pahlavi. He is part of a movement called the National Council of Iran. And he had some words of encouragement for the Iranian people and a strategy to help them overcome this oppression. Do you know February 1st, 1979, the Ayatollah Khomeini arrived in Tehran from Paris, and that birthed the Islamic Republic of Iran. And since 1979, there has been no democracy, there has been no freedom. But Reza Pahlavi, who lives here in the United States, is standing up for his people. He hasn't forgotten them. And I want you to hear this short interview of Reza discussing what's going on and what his plans are.
Iranian workers suffering from sky-high unemployment, roaring inflation, and unpaid wages. What's really going on and what can be done to solve it? We have the former Shah's son, Reza Pahlavi. He joins us now. Your Royal Highness, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Explain what you understand about what's going on in Iran now and what really sparked these recent protests we've been seeing.
Well, in a nutshell, we're talking about 40 years of utter mismanagement of the country's affairs under an extremely corrupt regime that couldn't care less about the fate of its citizenry, and instead is squandering our country's resources to conduct proxy wars and interference in other countries' domestic affairs in the region and beyond, with the sole ultimate goal of exporting their so-called ideology and impose it on others around the world. Result has been an economic decay which has led our country on the brink of economic collapse, major crisis in terms of people's inability to find work or jobs, poverty, inflation, you name it, an extremely dismal record that has ultimately boiled to a point that people are simply no longer able to tolerate this and are completely fed up and are asking for fundamental change and are demonstrating today in protest against this regime with the hope of having a different future.
And the different future comes down to the very basic things like having a job, having money coming in from work and things like that. How does that come back? How do we get from where the country needs to be from where it is now, which is clearly a bit of a mess?
Well, obviously, the difference where you have governments that care about their citizenry as opposed to one that does not, it makes a whole difference in the day. Iran should be South Korea today. Instead, it's North Korea. It's not that the country's resources have dwindled. It's not that the people are any different. The regime has changed. And as a result, the direction that our country took since 1979 has been today the results that you see. The Iranian people have had 40 years worth of experimentation under the tyrannical and authoritarian dictatorship of a clerical regime. And today, all the values that they aspire to, which is freedom, equality, human rights, justice, opportunities, non-discrimination of any form against anyone because of sexual orientation or ethnicity or religious denomination, is what the Iranian people at the very least are seeking. And in order to obtain the kind of governance that will progress, put the country back on the track of progress, obviously it has to be one that allows for people full participation, that is democratic in nature, that is secular in nature with a clear separation of religions from government, the only time we can have an element of sanity, transparency, accountability, responsibility, which is what governments are for, to be at service of their people, and public servants can do their job, as opposed to a system that cracks down on people the minute they have the slightest protest and use a machinery of coercion, which is deeply rooted in a paramilitary system that is now a ruling mafia in that country. We should not expect different result than what this regime has done.
Your Royal Highness, do you think it can be reformed? We keep hearing about reformist candidates for government within Iran. Can the system be reformed, or does it have to be just scrapped?
Well, this is something that the regime has tried for many years to try to fool people to believe in. And unfortunately, some people at some point actually believed that perhaps reform is possible. And they attempted it not once, not twice, but three times. And every time it has failed. The reason it has failed is simple. There is no possible way that you can bring about change of policy or laws in any country from a parliamentary process where unelected leaders with absolute final say can pretty much make the final decision. In other words, legislation is impossible under the current constitution to bring about any reforms. If tomorrow people, shall we say, want to put an end to this regime, there's no instrument that enables people to conduct free elections to do so under this system. There has never been a free election of people's chosen candidates. They have to go through a filtering process, and only the most dedicated to this regime passes through that seat. And at the end, people are forced to choose between the lesser of the evils, and then they end up with this guy or that guy, which at the end are there to preserve the system. So if there was any credence or any necessity to give an opportunity for the so-called reform to take place, today this concept is completely abandoned and forgotten because people know that this is just a waste of their time. It's never going to happen. So as far as I'm concerned, and millions of Iranians are concerned, this issue is dead. The next question is, we need to get rid of the system as a whole in order to obtain everything that we are aspiring for in order to govern ourselves and lead the country back to the path of prosperity and, of course, freedom.
Okay, the system has to go. There you heard it from His Royal Highness Reza Pahlavi. I'm Simon Constable, and that's it.
A really insightful interview. This is Reza Pahlavi, National Council of Iran, son of the former Shah of Iran, and he's reemphasizing that those forces and movements that think this regime is reformable, they're living in a fantasy land. The Iranian regime is oppressive, dictatorial, deadly, lethal. I can't think of enough adjectives to describe them. Yet there are those faithful Iranians. They're more nationalistic in their thinking. This country is the heart of the Middle East. You have North Korea. You have Russia. You have Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, and then Iran. Iran exports their terrorism. They support the Assad regime in Syria. They have been exporting terrorism since Khomeini assumed power in 1979. They were part of the Beirut disaster where American soldiers were killed. They have never stopped their claws across the world with terrorism. They used most, if not all, of the $150 billion that the Obama administration gave them a couple of years ago for terrorism. That's why you see so much economic woes in Iran. This uprising was not just about economic woes. It is a young generation of Iranians who are tired of being dictated day and night. They have no freedom of assembly, no freedom of religion. They have nothing. And so, yes, the economic squeeze is hard on them. They're tired of other countries benefiting from the money that they need. They're tired of the Iranian government with their claws into terrorism. They know what's going on. And so they took to the streets. But you have death to Khamenei statements. You have the burning of the Supreme Leader posters. Folks, this is not just about economics. That's why I hate the fake media. They try to paint a different picture of what was happening than really what was going on. Now, yes, most of the protests, not all, but most of them, have been quelled, have been quenched. But make no mistake, the Iranians know that February 1st and the month of February, which is the prelude to the Iranian New Year, is the 39th anniversary of Khomeini seizing power, of Ayatollahs and Mullahs seizing power. You don't think they're going to sit by idly. They will regather their strength, and they will rise up. And that's why here on the Cross in the Desert, you see videos. I write books about them, because Iran represents the balance of power in the Middle East. And for many reasons, if this Iranian regime can be taken over from within and a democratic society set up there, I believe the world in many ways will be at peace once again. That's not to say that we're totally at peace. We still have North Korea. We still have Russia. But the balance of power in the Middle East will dramatically change if we can put an end to this regime. And Reza Pahlavi, I think, has the very best plan, and I support him. He was on my radio broadcast just 2 years ago. He is an incredibly thinking individual. I think he has the solution. It still would be tough. It still will be a hard road to still be a leader. You still have forces that don't like the Pahlavi dynasty, that remember the Pahlavi dynasty, the monarchy. You would still have some factions of that, but yet, I would support Reza. I think he would be a great leader. Now, I want to shift gears here for a minute. A few weeks ago, we heard the hoopla and the outcry about Trump's remarks on certain countries dealing with the immigration policy. And he used the word S-H-I-T, supposedly. There are many that say he didn't say that. But the word, if you will, was attributed to him. Well, of course, the Democrats, the liberals got all up in arms. What a racist comment to make. And they went on and on. I want you to hear MRCTV reality check on the remarks of the president. Let's listen.
So here's a thought. If you've ever marched through the streets dressed as a vagina, claimed that America was never great, or screamed F Trump, you don't get to be morally outraged over Trump's use of the word asshole. Hey guys, I'm Brittany Hughes. You're watching MRCTV, and this is your reality check. The left is absolutely flipping out over Trump calling nations like Haiti and certain African countries assholes. The U.S. economy is doing great, by the way, but I guess this is what we're going to focus on today. Here's the real rub about what Trump said. It wasn't very presidential, but it was true. And everybody knows it. If it weren't, no one would be freaking out about Trump ending temporary protected status for Salvadorans and making them all go home. But the left is losing their ever-loving minds over it because everybody knows that places like El Salvador and Haiti and Somalia are not places that you want to go back to and take your kids. And it's not because their people aren't white. It's because they're gang-infested, crime-ridden, poverty-stricken wastelands whose governments shouldn't be running the local post office, much less a country. And everybody knows it, including their own people. That's why they gamble their lives and their kids' lives to scrape together a few bucks, risk falling off the top of a jam-packed train, cross the border, wander through the desert, and pray to God that they don't get abused by human traffickers, all just to get here. There's a reason that we have got a waiting list as long as the Rio Grande, filled with people desperate to get out of their current suckfest and come here. And anybody who doesn't buy that is welcome to hop on a plane, head on down to Venezuela, and set up shop in a local barrio and let me know how that works out for you. I've been there. They're socialist. You'll love it. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not perfectly lovely folks there who simply want to make a better life for their children. And yes, we should absolutely be a welcoming country for those who want to come here, work hard, assimilate into our culture, and build a wonderful new life for themselves and their families. Now, if you simply want to come here and transport all of the worst things about your society and just dump them into ours, maybe you should just stay home. But otherwise, we will try to help you out. We always have. But frankly, all of this drummed up moral outrage from the rabid left is nauseating. You guys call America a hole all the time. You burn our flag, protest our national anthem, insult our military, desecrate our memorial, spit on our police, mail condoms to our vice president, and call all of our white people racists. You guys march through the streets dressed as genitalia, you stomp around topless, and you scream profanity at the White House. So spare me your righteous indignation and your pearl clutching, and put your shirt back on. And stop pretending to give a crap about all of these poor people from all of these other nations that you have never set foot in, when you haven't given a crap about your own for a really long time. And that's your reality check, America. Subscribe to our YouTube page, like us on Facebook and Twitter, and stay sane out there.
Wow. I couldn't have said it better, Brittany Hughes. Thank you from MRCTV Reality. It is a breath of fresh air because her points are very well taken. This is the same crowd so outraged at the supposed use of the word by Trump. But these are the same people that trash our country. They've never stepped foot into a country like Haiti. What do they know? They don't know anything they're talking about. In the last half of the broadcast today, I want to teach us about a certain prophet in the Bible, a great example of not compromising. And I'm talking about Daniel the prophet. And we're going to learn about his life of a non-compromise right after this song by Russ Taff, which talks about not going to bow to your idols. Let's listen. Well, must have. I'm not going to bow. It's an appropriate song for the teaching I'm going to just be delivering to you right now. You want to know what a life of uncompromise looks like. You could probably have a lot of ideas. You could go to the Bible, excuse me, and really look at several figures of non-compromise. But the one that stands out the most radiant to me is Daniel the prophet. This is at a time in Israel where God allowed them to go into Babylonian captivity. Basically, it was a result of their disobedience. But they were taken into captivity in 397 B.C. in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So you have the famous King Nebuchadnezzar, who has come to take the children of Israel captive. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. This is at a time of Israel's great darkness and disobedience when they go into captivity. Now, I want to read to you what it looks like to be an uncompromising soldier for God during captivity. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, that is Nebuchadnezzar, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Asphanaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Listen, among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them their names. Daniel he called Belshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But, and I like this in the text, verse 8 of chapter 1, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. He's in captivity. He has been ordered to eat of this kind of food, to be educated, the pagan education, if you will, paganism 101. Daniel decided, that's not me. I am a worshiper of Yahweh, the one true God. And I will not bow down to this idolatry. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigns your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths or who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. In other words, look, you're going to have to do this or I'm in trouble with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, he says, quote, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. Notice when Daniel makes the absolute resolution to not be defiled by the king's food, his customs are teaching that God responded by giving him favor. When you take a stand for what is holy, when you take a stand for what pleases God. In your captivity, God will give you favor with those that are keeping you captive. And he said, look, I don't want to get you in trouble with your king. Test us, observe us, compare us with those that eat the king's food. And let us see that after 10 days, if our appearance, our learning, our understanding is not better than theirs. Okay. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there into the first year of King Cyrus. And notice what happens when you resolutely say to God and say to those that are keeping you captive, I will not compromise. I will not associate myself with the food dedicated to pagans. I will not associate myself with the literature and the teachings of paganism. I will do what my God says is right. I will not dishonor him, even though I'm in captivity. And he said, I know what I'm saying is true. Test us after 10 days, and you will see that we are better than those that ate the king's food. God honored his uncompromising attitude, and as a result, gave Daniel audience with King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, understand something. God did this not only for the uncompromising attitude of Daniel, but also to accomplish his purposes. Because you will see in chapter 2 that King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream that absolutely troubles him. And so he calls for the enchanters, the musicians, the astrologists to read and interpret his dream, and they cannot do it. But Daniel can. Because God favored Daniel and gave him wisdom greater than the soothsayers, greater than the occult practitioners. This ought to tell us something today about those that dabble in astrology and the occult. What is wrong with you? God says, I know the future. I know the end from the beginning. Why are you going to them? Daniel, I will give you the interpretation of the king's dream. And so Daniel the prophet does just that. And the king is astounded. Now, you may say when you look at chapter 2, well, all is well with King Nebuchadnezzar. Look at what he has done for Daniel. He interpreted the dream. Everything is right, right? Wrong. Because when you come to chapter 3, you have a whole different situation. You see, until God changes King Nebuchadnezzar's heart, he still loves and worships the pagan gods. And you're going to see now the ultimate test of non-compromising by Daniel. And so we're going to read Daniel chapter 3 together. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent together the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. By the way, when you go to Revelation chapter 13, there is an image set up by the Antichrist or the false prophet to worship. This is reminiscent of what King Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. He has had an image built to himself. Even though Daniel has interpreted his dream and shown that the true God is Yahweh, King Nebuchadnezzar nonetheless decides that that's not good enough for him, that he's the true God. And so he sets up this image, then calls all of these officials gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and language, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trijon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whosoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Well, if you are there and you look at that furnace, you're going to say, "Well, look, I value my life, my skin. You know, God knows I don't really mean this. I'm just going to bow down. You know, God, you understand I really don't mean that, right? Really?" Listen. "Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trijon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Well, they didn't think for a second. They immediately obeyed the royal decree. "Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trijon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image.'" Right? "And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trijon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is this God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Well, again, no compromise. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression on his face was changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast these men bound into the furnace?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not any power over the bodies of these men. The hairs of their heads were not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered, and he said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb." Nebuchadnezzar, in that brief moment, recognized Yahweh is the true God, that his pagan God had no power and no ability to stop Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that fourth man in the furnace, is Jesus. He will walk through the fire with us. He is with us through the fire. And when we stand and not compromise, he protects us and keeps us unscathed. I want to thank you so much for being tolerant of my voice today. And thank you so much for being a part of the Crossing the Desert. God bless you. I will see you again next Monday.